The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Gosh, I haven't been here to offer a talk since last October. It's been a long time. So, and part of that long time, actually it's still going on, as some of you may know, the 16th of January, I managed to trip over a telephone cord in my room and fractured my femur. And it was a complex fracture. I think this is the first time I've walked without a cane, thanks to Laurie Ottens, who's been very helpful in my physical therapy. And it's coming along. And I realized when Reverend Master Mayon kindly asked me to offer the Dharma talk, that the thing that still is foremost in my mind are the lessons that I learned in the rehab facility. The rehab facility was rehab long-term care, Justin Weed. We're really fortunate that it's so close, wonderful place. And my first impression of it was quite different than the impression that I had when I left 7 weeks later. I had surgery here at Mercy, and then 4 days later was shuttled over on a gurney to this place that I'd never been to. And you go in and you're like this looking around, and what I saw were people in wheelchairs and people in walkers, and they were all old. Not that I'm not, but, and I thought, it's an old folks' home. It's the last place I ever expected to be or wanted to be. And I went, oh. But as it turned out, I learned a number of Buddhist lessons, and it's not a Buddhist facility, but I learned a lot of Buddhist lessons anyway. So I'm going to share some of those lessons in letting go, is what Reverend Vera needed a title for the talk. I said, okay, lessons in letting go. So the first thing I learned was patience. And I found that, you know, there you are in a place where I was a registered nurse for 20 years. I worked in long-term care facilities. I figured I knew everything. I knew more than the people taking care of me. And so what I learned was it was okay to not get what I wanted, and it was okay to have something done in a way differently than what I would have done. And very, very tiny little things. One of the things that I most remember, and you know, I'm still probably a great tea drinker. When I was chaplain for Reverend Master Jiyu, there was a specific protocol for making her morning cup of tea. You warm the cup, yes, and then you pour the tea in and pour the hot water in, and you let it steep for 4 minutes, and then you served it. Well, I didn't think that was going to happen, but what I didn't think was going to happen is when my breakfast tray was brought, and I said, oh, could I have, hot water for tea? And they said yes, and back came a plastic cup with a coffee fragrance, and the water was barely warm. And I thought, and I would have sent it back, but that would have been another 20 minutes. But by the time a few days passed, I thought, you know, a tea bag will still steep in warm water. It's okay that it's a plastic cup. It's okay that a little coffee fragrance in it. I used to drink coffee. And so one by one, things happened to me that I could either accept and say thank you, or I could be grumpy and grouchy about it and ruin my day and theirs. But that didn't seem like such a good thing to do. I had no idea at the time how long I was going to be there. So that sort of thing continued on, right? The nutritionist brings you a menu or a list of foods that you can eat or not eat. She said, I understand you're vegetarian. We'll mark that on here. And you check off the things you can eat and the things you can't eat. And then the next meal are all the things you can't eat, none of the things you can eat. But after a while, it didn't matter. What really started to matter to me was that when someone brought the tray, there was a space on the bedside table for them to put it. So I was very careful not to clutter my bedside table. And that I said thank you to the person. And they would say, is there anything else I can get you? And I would either say yes or no. And I began to realize that there's a lot more going on here than the rehabilitation for my fracture. I had physical therapy twice a day. I wasn't allowed any weight bearing. So for any of you that are familiar with that, that means you can't just get out of bed and hop into the bathroom. You have to get out of bed and get on your bedside commode and all this other sort of thing. And so I would go out once or twice a day with a physical therapist with my walker, and I could only do toe touching. You could only just barely, touch your toe to the floor. And so and they call it hopping. And I thought, well, that's pretty good, because I remember long enough ago when I was a child, there were girls' games and boys' games. And one of the girls' games was hopscotch. And you would, make a little up whatever in the sidewalk, and then you'd throw a stone and hop. And I was very good at hopscotching. So I thought, okay, I can be very good at this, right? And I must say the three physical therapists that I had were just wonderful. And I would go out into the hall with my walker, and I would, and it was interesting because Reverend Master Jisho was in the same rehab facility, but he was there a little sooner than I was. So we would see each other and wave. He was in a wheelchair at that point. Anyway, I would go out with my walker, and I would see other people with their walkers or in their wheelchairs, or some people just in bed that weren't able to get out of bed. I remember coming to saying hello to this one fairly youngish man, probably under 40, and he had both legs amputated just below the knee. He was in a wheelchair. And it's interesting because when you see something like that or you read about it, that's one thing. But to say hello to that person, it brings it home to you how fortunate I am to have this fracture, to be able to use a walker, to be in a facility where people are kind and friendly and trying to take care of me. And the more I would go out at least twice a day into the hallway up to the nurse's station and back with my walker. And I never, ever got back without thinking, I'm so fortunate. I'm so fortunate. And instead of being either grumpy or despondent about not being at the Abbey, not being able to follow my monastic schedule, I began to look at things quite differently. And I began to look at how fortunate I was and what a wonderful, wonderful opportunity it was to actually put my Buddhist practice into practice. Maybe I could practice patience. Maybe I could practice all acceptance. Maybe I could practice letting go of my preconceived notions of who I was and who you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to do. And maybe even I could practice gratitude and forgiveness. And so I look back at those 7 weeks and the weeks since. This was, you know, early, middle January where I went in. And I think how fortunate I am to have had that experience. And so that's what I want to share with you today are lessons in letting go, which I'm still working on, mind you. I think it was a real, well, I wouldn't say that one blessing was greater than the other, but I think it. I started out realizing it with, as I said, practicing patience. Well, the meal is supposed to come at 7:20. Why isn't it here? You know, I asked for this, and it's not here. Our PT appointment was at 2 p.m. It's 2:30. Where is she or he? And you begin to realize, you think I would have learned this by now, right? How long have I been a monk? That it's okay to not get what you want. It's okay to not get what you expect. And out of that patience came a realization that before I can practice patience, I have to practice all acceptance. I have to be willing to just say thank you to whatever comes up and whatever happens. One of my current non-religious readings is a book by Malcolm Gladwell, and it's called David and Goliath. And it talks about, I kind of knew about David and Goliath, that there was this shepherd boy that killed this huge giant, right, a long time ago. Oops, sorry, Reverend Viewer. And what Malcolm Gladwell says in David and Goliath, and later on, or maybe it was earlier, in a book called Blink, that things are not always what they seem, that because our habitual perspective, the way I think about things, what my habits of looking and seeing are, can obscure the current reality of what we are seeing and what we are understanding. And that was certainly the case for me there in the rehab facility that I had. And this was from many years of experience, and the experience certainly served me in good stead of being a nurse, that things should be done this way. And if I ask someone to empty the commode, and they go over and they pick up the lid and look in and put the lid down and walk out, that's not what you do as a good nurse. But that's what happened, and I just said, thank you. And I thought, well, I can't empty it myself. Somebody will have to do it sometime. But our habitual perspective just really obscures our understanding of what's happened. And what Malcolm Gladwell pointed out in that episode, in his retelling of David and Goliath, that disadvantages may not be disadvantages. The fact that Goliath was, 6'9" and 300 pounds and wearing all this armor, and David was a young shepherd lad and had 5 stones, but he knew how to sling them, was not a disadvantage. It was actually an advantage because, in that instance, no one thought that David would be able to kill Goliath, and no one thought Goliath was in any danger. So what we need to think about is that what we think of as a negative situation may really be the most beneficial thing that could happen to us, an absolute positive thing, if we can look at it from the point of view of patience, acceptance, and let go of our habitual thoughts on it. Along with that, and part of that, I found that, kind of going back to the tea story, that letting go of my preferences which I didn't think I had any left, right, after 30 years of monastic training, but that's not true. That's not true. That I could look at the fact that getting what I wanted might not actually be the best thing, that there might be something different there. And so I brought back with me the both satisfying and disturbing realization that I have a lot of preferences. I have a lot of preferences. I don't think I can look at the wonderful biscuits that Reverend Allard bakes and not think, oh, that's the one I want. And so what I've started to do to get myself past there is I look for the one that's either the tiniest or that's a little overdone or whatever that maybe nobody else will take, and I take that one. And it's been so helpful in realizing that, one, I have preferences, and two, there are ways to overcome them, you know. I can walk in the ceremony hall, right, and think, well, why did they put that there? It's supposed to be a quarter of an inch that way. And I can give that up. I can say, isn't it nice? I've been able the last 2 days to actually come to morning service. I haven't been to morning service in months. And I thought, you know, I'm going to stop criticizing the way that somebody does something or the way that something's done and just be grateful that it's here and grateful that I'm here. You know, I could be out in the world causing all kinds of havoc, but I'm here in the havoc that I cause people put up with and help me with. So I think a good place to start in preferences is recognizing the preferences and letting go. Now, I'm not saying giving up, because I don't think you can give up something that you don't already have. And that preference isn't something that's mine. It's something that I've developed, something that I've learned, and I can give it up. I don't have to keep it. What came to me, I think, particularly in the rehab facility, is there were a couple of people on hospice care, was realizing that letting go is more than letting go of my preference for a hot steaming cup of water for my tea, but that when I die, I'm going to have to let go of a lot of things that I think are important. And I've had the great good fortune since I've been at the Abbey, I think I counted the other day the number of dying monks that I've helped to take care of. And one of the things that you, and each one is different, the dying for each one is different, and one of the things that I think about is at the time of death, when you're dying, whether it's 6 months or 6 hours, I'm not going to be able to go back and replay my life. What if I've said thank you to someone? Wonderful. If I haven't said thank you, I'm really sorry about that, but I'm probably not going to get a chance to do that. So that letting go of my preferences has a lot to do with getting ready to let go when I'm at the point of dying, which, you know, at 85 isn't going to be all that long. Maybe not tomorrow, but who knows? The other thing I learned, and that's important for me, was that the things I'm talking about were not sequential. You don't learn patience, and then you don't learn all acceptance, and then you don't learn letting go. They're all entangled with each other, and they come up on their own, so to speak. You have to make the effort, but you can't say, okay, patience, get to work. It's not going to work, let me tell you. You have to just take the effort, make the time to do what needs to be done in that moment. I found a good place to start, though, in letting go is letting go of the grasping, letting go of the, I need this, I have to have this, holding on to something. It doesn't work. I also found that gratitude was a big part of this, that if I could say thank you to someone, even though I wasn't really grateful, even though it felt phony and artificial, that somehow it softened the situation, and I could just say thank you. And a lot of times somebody would smile and say, oh, you're welcome. And I realized, I mean, you know, they're delivering food and services to a lot of people that are in pain, don't know what's going on, in a difficult situation. Probably not everybody that they see says thank you. And so for some of them, maybe the first time all day, who knows. A long number of years ago, I read a book by Parker Palmer. It was called Let Your Life Speak. My recollection is, although it could be wrong, that he was a Quaker, that his, and I had worked with Quakers long ago when I was in Seattle. I thought they were the closest thing to Buddhists that I'd come across. His title refers to the ideals that you have, the motives and the habits should be something that your life reflects outward. You know, if I read the precepts every day and I recite them hourly and I don't put them into practice, I'm not letting my life speak. You know, my life as a Buddhist is the precepts, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and all of the Buddhist teachings that we have. And if I'm not able to manifest those teachings in my daily life, then what's the point? And at some point, I found when I was at the rehab facility that people, the staff would come and say, now, you and Rear Master Jisho are Buddhist, right? What does that mean? Or they'd ask me something else, and they weren't about to become Buddhist. They didn't want a great big academic thing. And I would just say, well, you know, and answer them in whatever straightforward way I could. And I realized that by expressing my gratitude, by accepting what happened, by being patient, that I was saying, whether I thought about it or not, I was saying, this is how a Buddhist lives their life. And what made me realize that was when one of the nurses, I think she was one of the night staff, came and said, I'm going to bring a book to you. And I thought, oh, okay. And so she brought a book to me, and it was called The Book of Joy, and it's by the Dalai Lama and the late Desmond Tutu. And she said, I thought you might like this. And I was tempted. My first response was going to be, oh, I've read that. And something said, Scholastica, it doesn't matter whether you've read it or not. This is an offering from someone. So I said, oh, thank you very much. And then I thought, well, what do I do now? I've already read this book. I don't know. And so I read one chapter a night in that book. And it was as though I'd never read the book before. And I realized that when I read the book, I was the person that read the book then. But reading the book then, I was the person that I was then, if that makes sense. Probably not good grammar. And it was a wonderful opportunity because that book had so much good advice and so much inspiration for me. And I was so grateful to her. And at the end of the stay, I said, I finished it and I want to return it. And she said, oh, no, you can keep it. You can keep it. But she was so pleased that she was able to offer me something that seemed important and seemed good to do. So I think that the question that came up for me in reading that book and in thinking back to Parker Palmer's book, Let Your Life Speak, what if our thoughts were as audible to others as our actions? That'd be pretty embarrassing, wouldn't it? Devastating, I would think. But ever since I had that thought, I thought, well, you know, in a way, our thoughts are audible to other people because our thoughts preface our speech, and often our speech prefaces our actions. And so since realizing that and getting back from the rehab facility, I have been trying, I don't always succeed, but I've been trying to be very careful about going along with my thoughts, right? I start thinking, why is... And I thought, no, we're not criticizing, remember? We're not criticizing. Oh, okay. And I try to either just let the thought go or replace it with a thought of gratitude, you know? Instead of, why isn't that person doing that? Think of all the stuff that person does. And you'd think a monk wouldn't have these thoughts, would you? But at least for me, that's not true. I think I can be as critical and judgmental now as I used to be in my former life. And I think one of the problems with our habits is that at some point in our life, our habits are useful. You know, I was in journalism for a long time. I was in public relations. I was a nurse. And having a critical and a judgmental mind is really important. It takes you a long way. It's necessary. You need to do that. But as we advance in our practice, we don't need those critical and judgmental things. I mean, yeah, if I'm crossing the street and a fast car is coming, I want to be judgmental and say, Scholastica, don't go out there. But that's not what I'm talking about, and you know it. The other thing that came up for me, particularly in rereading the Book of Joy, and then I have recently been reading the Dalai Lama's book on the compassionate life, is what a large part forgiveness plays in letting go. What a large part forgiveness plays in patience, acceptance, gratitude. Because we have to, took me a while to get to this, we have to be able to forgive ourselves before we can forgive other people. I have to be able to say, it's okay, Scholastica, that I'm not perfect according to my definition of perfect. Because if I recall, Reverend Master Chiyu would always say, I think it's a Buddhist teaching, we're perfect just as we are. We have exactly what we need to live in this moment. And I needed to forgive myself for my critical mind and my judgmental mind before I could forgive someone else for being critical and judgmental. And that has made such a difference to me when I realized that I can practice forgiveness from the minute I get up in the morning until the minute I go to bed at night. And it's made a big difference. The other thing that has been helpful for me is to really take to heart a number of the verses that we have as part of our practice. in the morning when I wake up and before I get out of bed, I recite a little verse thanking all the bodhisattvas in the world for all the work that they're doing. And I offer the merit of that day's training to all those in Ukraine. And it has made such a difference to me because along with it, I think of what can I express my gratitude for? And that is something that I can refer to back through the day. And acceptance is a big part of that. And when I was thinking about verses the other day, I thought about this lovely little poem by A.A. Milne, M-I-L-N-E, you may recall. He's written some lovely books called Winnie the Pooh. This is the verse that I like. If you were a bird and you lived very high, you lived on the wind as the breeze came by. You said to the wind as it took you away, that's where I want to go today. And I thought, isn't that wonderful to just say, what is there for me to do today? What is there for me to do today? What is it that needs to be done that I could do? And I don't have to say, I want to do this and I want to do that. I can just accept whatever comes along. There's another verse that I like to say, sometimes in the morning. I often say it at night. And I think it's part of the verses that we would find in the Metta Sutra. And this is my particular translation. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings practice gratitude and generosity. May all beings live together in harmony. And that's my offering to the world, because this is where I am. You know, I'm not, you know, a nurse out in the front lines in Ukraine. I'm not working with the homeless. This is where I am. What can I do today? I can offer merit for all beings. I was intrigued when I was reading rereading The Compassionate Life by the Dalai Lama. And in his last chapter, he talks about 8 verses for training the mind. And I'm not going to read you all of them, but I'll read you the last one. And then I'll read you a final one. And he's talking about all beings. May they not be defiled by the concepts of the 8 mundane concerns, and aware that all things are illusory, may they, ungrasping, be free from bondage. So when we ask that people be happy and peaceful, when we ask that all beings practice gratitude and generosity, we're wishing that they not be defiled by praise and game and elation and sorrow and etc., etc., and aware that all things are illusory, that all things are delusions, and may they be free from bondage, may they be free from the fetters of self. So what we're wishing all beings is that they have the opportunity to practice the Dharma the way that we do. He has a nice summary at the end. Where he says, I'll get to it. And I particularly like this because it's a verse from Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva. And we'll have a chance, I'm sure, to hear other versions of this when Mer Master Mayan gives her retreat in August on the Bodhisattva Way. As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain. Until then, may I too remain and dispel the miseries of the world. I first came across that in the way of the Bodhisattva at a bookshop in Edinburgh when I was visiting our priory over there. And I was so impressed with it, I bought it, even though I'd have to bring it back with me on the plane. And my own version of that is, as long as space abides, as long as beings abide, so too may I abide to heal the suffering of the world. So for me, having verses to recite is a wonderful grounding and centering. And I would encourage you, I mean, we've got a number of verses in any of our Buddhist texts, to think about having a verse that you can recite in the morning and a verse that you can recite in the evening. And one of the other things that's, I'm a visual person along with liking words. And so one of the things that came to mind when I was thinking about all acceptance and letting go and kind of looking on the good side of things was a little three-frame cartoon. This has been years ago. It was a Peanuts cartoon. And Snoopy is sitting on his doghouse with his typewriter. Before computers, his typewriter. And Lucy is standing there with a piece of paper, and she's reading it. He's obviously handed it to her. And she says, I just don't believe how stupid your stories are. And Snoopy's sitting up there looking at her, and she says, in fact, handing it back to him, I can't see anything good at all about your writing. So Snoopy takes a piece of paper that he's written and he looks at it. And then he says, I have neat margins. And I thought, isn't it wonderful to be able to, one, accept criticism from someone without getting overpowered by it, and secondly, to look at the good things that you are doing, because all of us, I mean, here I am, I've been a monk for, what, 30-some years, and I can say, well, I made this mistake and this mistake and this mistake and this mistake, and I still am working on this, that, and the other thing. But I can also say, gee, Scholastic, isn't it nice you recognize that mistake 24 hours later rather than 3 months later? So there you go. So I think to be able to look at our good aspects helps us to look at other people's good aspects. So I came away from my 7 weeks in rehab, and it's been 6 months now, and I realized that I've gone back to what became essential for me, I don't know, a number of years ago, which was, if I can say thank you, and if I can smile, that's okay. I don't need to know all of the ins and outs of all the Dharma and all the scriptures and et cetera, et cetera. I need to be able to know what the essence of the Dharma is, and to put it into practice in my everyday life. So I wanted to take this opportunity, I don't know whether I can do this without tearing up, to thank all of you who came to visit me in rehab. And there are a number of people here that did that, brought me treats, came to visit, sent me wonderful get well, have a quick recovery cards. And to all the monks that came to see me while I was there and that are still supporting me. So thank you all very much for your practice, and thank you for helping me with mine. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.